Welcome to the Hot Stove.
Going and going. Goodbye, baseball. Nelson Cruz.
On 710 ESPN Seattle, 710sports.com, and the 710 Seattle Sports app.
The Kings 1-2 swing and a miss. He gets them with me on a changeup.
Let's fire up the Hot Stove and talk some Mariners baseball. Here's your host, Rick Riz.
And welcome to the second hour of Hot Stove Baseball. Here we go. Rick Reeves, Shannon Dreher, Dave Valley, producer-engineer Kevin Kremen. All right, we had the trivia question. And the question at the end of the first hour, which Mariner won a Pitcher of the Month award last season? That was the question. Let's go to the audio vault for the answer.
Curveball is a strike three call. Second time, Chris Young has been caught admiring the hook from James Paxton tonight, as Paxton has now tied a career-best 10 strikeouts.
The set, and the 1-2 to Gallo. Swing and a miss, and a breaking ball in the dirt for strike three. Down goes Gallo. 9 strikeouts for the lefty from Ladner, James Paxton.
Yeah, I could hear them screaming, A, when I had got the 2 strikes. That was pretty fun.
The payoff pitch. It is strike three called with a curveball. Holy smokes, on the inside corner. James Paxton breaking out that slow curveball, and he strikes out Beltran on a 3-2 pitch. He struck out Altuve on a 3-2 curveball for a big second out in the bottom of the third. What a pitch.
And the answer, James Paxton, that was correct. Our winner is Steve Peters from Shoreline. So congratulations to Steve Peters. Steve wins the new 2018 Mariners batting practice cap, which is available in all Mariners team stores. So, Steve, way to go. The answer, James Paxton. Shannon, Val, I can't wait to see this guy in 2018. After what he did last year, he had those great bursts, especially early in the season when he had that great run, and then he had to deal with a couple of injuries. But, Shannon, I can't wait to see what James Paxton is going to do for this ball club.
I think he's put it all together. I think it's just a matter of health at this point, and he talked at the end of the season and getting with a number of different specialists. I called them all the witch doctors and whatever it takes for him to, you know, just find. He was talking about different, getting all the testing to see body composition. Is that kind of contributing to some of the problems he's had? But he's somebody that no doubt will benefit from the new peak performance department that they have, Dr. Lorena Martin. I'm sure he's probably already talked to her a little bit, and they're really going to try and cut down on all injuries, soft tissue injuries in particular. But it's been fun to watch Paxton a little bit through the off season on the social media. You heard Scott Servais say that he was one of the guys who was down with the Nelson Cruz group working out down in pre-spring training, Nelson's little camp that he had. Been living in Wisconsin in the off season. His wife is from there, and yeah. I mean, that's almost Canada, so I'm sure he fits in there.
Close.
Wear the flannel
yeah.
shirt and go.
Do they have
exactly.
moose in Wisconsin?
Of course.
Yes.
Yeah, lots of meese up there.
Yeah.
I think he went to a Packers game, but it'll be fun to catch up with him.
Scott will like that. He's a big cheesehead. With the way starting pitching has been going, Val, and you've been around this game a long time and caught in the big leagues for a long time, we're seeing starters going fewer and fewer innings and more innings on the bullpen. James Paxton is a guy that will get you deep into a ball game. You have to have that guy. You have to have two guys in that rotation, at least two, hopefully three, that can get you deep into a ball game to save the bullpen. And Paxton, he's that guy.
Well, I think he proved to everybody last year the type of talent that he has, the overpowering stuff. He made a couple of changes, a couple of tweaks in his delivery, which increased his velocity. He was throwing, 100 numerous times, but this is a guy that can absolutely dominate when he is on. So, and we saw that. So it's not something we're talking about. It's not a potential thing. He's done it. He, as Shannon mentioned, if he can just stay healthy and figure out how he can be able to take that ball every 5 days, we're going to see something special. But even with the way the game has changed, even with the things, they're using the term bullpenning, I think the Mariners are really strengthening up their bullpen to have a little bit more options to be able to do that. But you still need the horse. You still need a guy who's going to get you seven or eight innings every once in a while. Yeah, because otherwise you're churning through that pen. And I don't know if there's, they still are thinking about it and talking about it in theory, but you still need the Clayton Kershaw, the guy who can give you a complete game every once in a while. Or not that he has to, but those 6, 7, 8 innings on a consistent basis, he's a guy that's able to do that.
He's a guy that, I mean, his mindset, the last 2 years, he's been ready. I mean, he has been focusing that if they were to get into the postseason, and they were close 2 years ago, and they fell out earlier this year, that he was the one who was lining up for that number one game, and he was getting prepared for that. He was getting mentally prepared for that. Now it's just a matter of just getting him there. And, you know, interesting, a name that we didn't hear Scott Servais bring up is Felix Hernandez, and to have a full off season and to get those injuries behind him again, to have a handle of what he's been dealing with, and just kind of the glimpses that we saw. Every time I looked at Felix last year in the work, when he wasn't dealing with the injuries, you saw, if you can put this and this and this together, this guy's still got enough to be very, very effective out there. You know he's got the smarts. You know he can compete. It's a matter of getting that together, too.
And I think that's where what you're talking about, Rick, the fact that the game is changing a little bit as Felix gets older. He's, I think, in the top four or five as far as number of pitches thrown in the major leagues since he joined the major leagues. So there's a lot of wear and tear on his body, on his arm. So I'm sure he's learning how to try to keep old man time away by working a little bit harder, a little bit smarter. But I don't think you're going to be looking at Felix as a guy that's going to give you 7, 8, 9 innings or even, you know, a complete game. I think those days are probably gone for him, but I still believe he can be incredibly effective, and that's why you want to have that strong bullpen. So if he's going to give you 100 pitches, you know, we've seen in the past, sometimes that 100 pitches can take him into the 6th or 7th. Sometimes it's the 4th or 5th. So hopefully it's the latter.
I love the way he competes, and that's why he's been so good for 12 years and came up at the age of 19. Paxton, he made that quick adjustment a couple of years ago. He went from over the top to a little more three quarters. All of a sudden, 94, 95 was 97, 98, 99, even 100. Lance Painter, the pitching coach down at AAA Tacoma, rolled him a ball and said, throw it. He threw it from that arm slot, which he came up with 2 years ago. He says, that's where you should pitch from. Val, is it sometimes that simple? You make an adjustment like that, and all of a sudden you go 94, 95 to 97, 98 with control?
That was the biggest surprise for me. You know, you talked to him about him throwing up into the triple digits, and it's effortless. Yeah. I think coming from the side, which is probably more of a natural movement for his arm slot, I think that's where that effortlessness comes from. I think that's where that ball's starting to jump. When he was getting up over the top, it was much more of a forced movement through the shoulder, and I think that's why he didn't have the velocity that he has now since he's dropped down into that slot. But yes, it's oftentimes a little thing. Once you get to this level, you're one of the best players on the planet, right? There's only 750 Major League Baseball jobs out there. You're one of them. Yeah. And it's the little things. It's the little adjustments. Whether you're a hitter and you tweak things. You know, we talked about Mike Zunino changing some things. The talent is there. Now, to be able to maximize it and get the most out of it, oftentimes it's going to be a little thing. And, you know, thank goodness for people like Painter who made this suggestion, because we're reaping the benefits by watching him take that ball every 5 days.
And one thing of note, the Mariners have added an extra coach this offseason. And instead of having that extra coach be an extra hitting coach, it's an extra coach on the pitching side. So it'll be interesting to see how they work with the three. Your pitching coach is Mel Stottlemyre Jr. But with the three, now rather than just having one guy trying to handle everything, you've got three guys who are going to have kind of more specific assignments and be able to help out.
Yeah, Stottlemyre was awesome last year with 40 different pitchers and got them prepared and ready to go each and every day. What was really cool about James Paxton? The Maple Grove. His own cheering section up there in the upper deck in left field. They even had a tree up there.
That was impressive. The tree. The maple tree. And do you remember the name of the tree?
Stick Riz.
You think it was decorated for Christmas?
I hope so. I don't know where that tree is, but we'll see it in the upper deck when James pitches on opening day here. So it's going to be something. So he's got his own cheering section. Felix has his, and now James Paxton. You know you arrived when you have your own cheering section.
Absolutely.
Oh, James Paxton, the answer, pitcher of the month in April. He was outstanding there. And I'll tell you what, we got more here in the second hour of Hot Stove. We're going to visit with a young pitcher who came over from the St. Louis Cardinals last year, makes his home here in the Seattle area, went to Gonzaga. Marco Gonzalez is going to be our guest coming up right after this timeout.
All things Mariners, all off-season. The Hot Stove on 710 ESPN Seattle, 710sports.com, and the 710 Seattle Sports app.
Say, friends, now is the time to get on board for the 2018 season. As a Mariners season ticket holder, whether you're looking to spend quality time with your family and friends or have more face time with your employees and clients, Mariners season tickets provide unmatched value and versatility. Visit Mariners.com/18 for more information. Hot Stove Baseball on a chilly, rainy night here in Seattle. Right now, we're going to go back to the Caravan, and Aaron Goldsmith is on the Caravan heading to Eastern Washington along with Taylor Motter and Mariner pitcher Marco Gonzalez. And Aaron caught up with Marco Gonzalez. Here's Aaron with Marco.
Marco, it's great to see you again, even though you haven't been far from us in Seattle during the entire offseason. But now you're back in your old stomping grounds, man. This is Marco territory. What's it like being back in Eastern Washington?
I don't know if Marco territory is the correct terminology, but it feels amazing to be back. This is kind of where my road started for sure. You know, we were in Wenatchee last night, and I got to see my host family, and I was telling them that this is really special because this is where my career started, I think. You know, forming into a college player, that's the kind of guy that I am now. And so, you know, on the field, off the field, this is where it all began for me, so it's very special.
And your host family, because this was with the Wenatchee Apple Sox before you even became a Zag, right?
Yeah, I went and played there after my high school senior season. Got a taste of some college baseball, and man, it was a rude awakening for me. I got to really be humbled that summer and come in with a good mentality into Gonzaga, and I also got to play with five or six of my future teammates too. So that summer, I made some lifelong friends. Obviously, I'm still really close to my host family, and it was just very special times.
Now you're a Colorado guy. What was it that brought you out to Gonzaga?
Honestly, the opportunity to come and play for an up-and-coming program. You know, that's kind of how the coaches sold me, who are phenomenal coaches, by the way. That's another factor. But, you know, the speech was that Gonzaga is going to turn its baseball program around like the basketball program did, basically burst onto the scene. And that's what they've done. They made it to a regional last year. They've really kind of turned a corner and gotten a ton of recruits. But they sold me as we're trying to develop this program and blow it up. And so I wanted to be a part of that, and I wanted to help be a catalyst in that. And hopefully the job's not done. I'm an active alum. I donate as much as I can, and obviously try to make an annual alumni weekend if I can too. But it's just a special place, has a special place in my heart, and I'm a devoted, proud Zag for sure.
And you met your wife there, correct?
I did. So, I mean, this, you know, that's really the big bonus, let's be honest. I outkicked my coverage, and marrying a Zag was the best decision I've ever made, so.
Well, for those at home who don't know about it, Mariners fans might live really close to you. You are a Seattleite. You spent time in West Seattle and Capitol Hill, and you work out at Safeco Field during the offseason. What's it like living in the town where you actually report to work? Not many big leaguers can say they do that.
Yeah, it's really, really interesting, actually. It's interesting having the facility to yourself. Sometimes I'm in there and I feel like I could be the last man on earth, you know, just kind of grinding away, you know, blasting the music as loud as I can. And, you know, but it's been a blast. Honestly, the training staff has been there, and working out with them has been really great. But yeah, I've been in and out of downtown, been bouncing around the stores and the restaurants and coffee shops. So if anybody, you know, if you see me around, you know, I'm just a normal guy trying to stay out of the cold, trying to drink a lot of coffee. So,
hey, you've had a chance to interact with somebody who Mariners fans don't know a lot about right now, but they will see the benefits of her labor the coming seasons. That's Dr. Lorena Martin, who's the director of high performance for the Mariners. This is a whole new campaign, really, that Jerry Dipoto has put on, mainly because of injuries and specifically to the pitching staff a season ago. Can you tell us about Dr. Lorena Martin, your interactions with her, and kind of what you see, how she will help the Mariners in the season to come?
Yeah, I mean, the director of high performance really doesn't do it justice, because this woman is truly incredible. She's got like 17 degrees, and she's got, I don't want to get it wrong, but I know she has a couple, like she has a PhD, a doctorate in something else, and it's just talking to her, you understand that she really knows her stuff. And basically her role is going to be combining every aspect of training that we do on the field, off the field, put it into a quantifiable number, and then adjust our workload based on that. So it's really interesting. She's focused on our diets, our workouts, obviously, training room routine. It's going to be really interesting to see how it all unfolds. But, you know, we feel as players as though the organization is making steps to keep us healthier.
Now, she is so in-depth that she called your wife.
She did call my wife. it was borderline. No, I'm just no. She the first time I met her, she said, you know, how's your nutrition? I said, great. My wife is actually a personal trainer, and she's big health and fitness nut, so she's on top of it. And she goes, well, great. I'd like to have her number and call her to see what you guys have in your fridge and to see how you eat. And I was like, oh man, like I kind of got nervous because I just was anxious about it. But she's very detail oriented. She wants to know our backgrounds and everything about our lives.
This will be your first full season, I should say, post Tommy John surgery. First, let's go back to the time when you got the news that you would need the operation. I'm curious, Tommy John has become such a commonplace thing in the game that I wonder, maybe a decade ago, if a pitcher found out that he needed Tommy John, there might have been more of a sweat than a pitcher that finds out in today's era that they need Tommy John. How did you react when you first heard the news?
Yeah, it's changed a lot. It's become a mainstream surgery, honestly. It's been done thousands, hundreds of thousands of times. I don't know. But basically, when I found out, it was shocking. You know, to hear that your ligament's torn and to hear that you're not going to be able to throw a baseball for over a year is pretty tough. And or in a game for over a year is pretty tough. And so, you know, I took a little while, maybe the rest of that afternoon or something, and really kind of just let it sit, kind of let the news sit. And then the next day, your mentality changes. You turn into a rehabber, you know, and taking a break from your work on the field, redirecting it into your rehab exercises, your diet, your nutrition, everything that goes into it. That's kind of your new goal. And so I've had so many friends, unfortunately, go through it. So many teammates that I know what it entails, and I know how tough it is. And so I was blessed, actually, to have a lot of advice come my way from guys like Adam Wainwright, Lance Lynn, a couple college buddies, basically just giving me advice on, you know, take it a week at a time. You know, don't look too far ahead. Don't look too far behind. Just be in the moment, and it flies by. And they were absolutely right. I was pitching again 13 months later back in AAA, and then 2 months after that, I was in Seattle. So it was a wild ride, and I'm very thankful for it because it's humbled me a lot. It's made me appreciate every second I have on the field, and it's also made me appreciate my career as a whole because, you know, you don't know what can happen. You really, any day you get on the field is really a special one. So counting my blessings after that for sure.
Well, this will also be your first full season as a Seattle Mariner. Most guys are excited when they find out that they get traded because that means that somebody wants them, and more times than not, it's a better opportunity someplace else. But it must have been extra special for you since you live in Seattle to come to the Mariners. Was it almost surreal?
Yeah, it was. When I heard, I was actually half asleep when I got the call, and we had been bussing through the night, and I woke up at like 10 a.m. to a phone call. But, you know, it was just such a surreal day, you know, and realizing that you're packing your bags. It was the easiest pack that we've ever had. My wife and I moved 3 times this year, and it was by far the most fun we had traveling back across the country because we were going home in a sense. Mm-hmm. And my wife is from Sammamish, about 20 minutes away from Seattle. And so for her to be close to her family, the sacrifices she's made for my career, it was very special for her to be home and to be in her community. We have a bunch of college friends in town too. So for us to be there and to be comfortable, I think that's going to be really great for all, obviously on the field purposes, but off the field, you know, we're very comfortable there.
And what's that first time like pitching in a different uniform?
It was strange. It was very surreal. I made a couple starts in Tacoma to start, and that didn't feel – it hadn't hit me yet.
Really?
You know, because we played in OKC and then back in Tacoma, a couple places I had already been, and so it didn't feel really like I had made a change. And then when I got called up to go pitch in Kansas City, that I walked in the clubhouse and saw some different colors, and that kind of messed with me a little bit, seeing some different faces and things like that. But after a week or so trying to get everybody's name down, I still don't know if I have everybody's name down, That's when it really, you start to kind of fit in a groove and get in a routine, and that's when you really start to kind of take off, is when you can get comfortable again.
I guess as long as you know Zunino's name and Mel's name, those are probably the two most important. How's your relationship with those two guys developed?
Yeah, they've been outstanding, honestly. The transition process as far as the coaching staff and the players, the Mariners have a lot of moves. They've got a lot of guys coming in and out, and so I think for a guy transitioning, it's not, unnatural to guys to get to know a new face and things like that. So they've gotten to know me. I've gotten to know them, what each other's likes, dislikes are, how we like to prepare. Those sort of things are talked about daily. And so I've talked with Mel a couple times this offseason, talked with Mike, and they're both very excited for the upcoming year.
You know, Marco, even though we've really blown the caravan budget on added security for you in Spokane for the autograph hounds, that type of thing, it's going to cut a whole leg of the caravan off, which Sean Grenley is very frustrated with. Despite that, your presence has been a real treat. Thanks so much for joining us.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much for having me.
Aaron, thanks so much. We're going to love watching this kid pitch in 2018. He came over from the St. Louis Cardinals last year. Marco Gonzalez on the Mariners caravan, and we're going to be back with more. We're going to visit with one of the great writers in the game of baseball. We're going to visit with Tracy Ringlesby coming up here in the second hour of Hot Stove Baseball right after this timeout.
Back to more of the Hot Stove on 710 ESPN Seattle, 710sports.com, and the 710 Seattle Sports app.
All right, now we have a chance to visit with, I think, one of the more respected guys I've ever met in the game of baseball, covering the game of baseball, writing about baseball, Tracy Ringlesby, who went into the Hall of Fame a number of years ago, I think the year or two before Dave went in. And he has covered baseball for many, many years, spent years here in Seattle. Tracy, thanks for joining us tonight here on Hot Stove up here in Seattle.
I've been around so long, Rick, that I remember when Dave Alley was a baby.
I do, too. What do you remember about it?
Easy.
Hold on. What do you remember about a young Dave Valley? Let's go there right now.
No, I would rather tell stories about Harold Reynolds. That's safer. He's not on the air with you right now.
Give me one about Harold. Give me one about, because I'll be seeing him soon.
When they played at Wausau, he and Darnell Coles were roommates.
That's right.
Used to get up on Saturday mornings, and they didn't have a TV, so they would take their Cocoa Puffs and go to Manager Plummer's apartment and lay on the couch and eat Cocoa Puffs and watch cartoons.
He told me one time, when Harold first came up, he looked like he was 16 years old. He couldn't get in the ballpark. He couldn't get in the kingdom. They didn't believe that he was the new second baseman for the ball club. Well, Tracy, how you doing, buddy? Enjoying the it's not much of an off season, is it, for a writer? Trying to figure out what teams are doing and getting ready for 2018. Tell us about your off season.
My offseason is really pretty calm. Now I don't have to do day-to-day work. I just do columns. I just pontificate. But it's been fun to watch the Rockies because a year ago, they're kind of like the Mariners have been over the years, that nobody really pays attention to them. And then when they have success, people are like, gee, I didn't think they'd be that good. And it's like, well, because you never paid attention to the team. And I know, like, last year people are surprised the team played well. The only reason the people who were around the team all the time were surprised is that when the season opened, their projected starting catcher had a broken forearm, their projected starting first baseman had a broken hand, and their projected starting left fielder had pulled something in the back that affected his – well, he played 17 games all year in the minor leagues. Their number one starter had a broken foot, and their number two starter had testicular cancer, and they still got to the playoffs. So – I just think people don't look at the teams like Seattle or Colorado and want to give them credit for the fact that they could build a competitive team and be a good team. And so when they do have success, people are like, man, I didn't see that coming. Well, you got to look to see.
Well, Tracy, I think a big kind of eye-opener with the Rockies this year was they did a lot of it with pitching, which you don't always expect in Colorado. But then you look at what they're doing in the offseason, and they are very much invested in pitching and what they've done with the bullpen, a bullpen that seems to be the envy a little bit of Jerry DePoto, who in his Wheelhouse podcast said they just did great things.
Well, the first thing when Darren Holmes and Foster came back and they got rid of Bill Guyvet, who was ruining the organization, they said, Holmes goes, I pitched in Colorado for 5 years and I threw curveballs my number one pitch. And Foster goes, well, I don't know why you can't throw a curveball here. And so they reinstituted the curveball. And that was a big thing for Chad Bettis, because when he was drafted because he had a great curveball, and then Bill Guyvet took it away from him, if that makes sense. But, you know, I got to talk to Bert Hooten, and there's an older man that died a few years ago named Buss Campbell, who was the pitching guru in Colorado. And he taught Bert Hooten how to throw a pitch called a knuckle curve when he coached him in Boulder on the Boulder Collegians. It's a matter of making the pitchers believe they can throw pitches and get people out. And then it's amazing if you don't tell them they can't do it, sometimes they figure out ways to do it. And as Hooten said, you know, pitching is making adjustments to the conditions. He goes, I pitched at Dodger Stadium. I had to make adjustments every time I pitched. You can throw a curveball at Colorado. You just have to release it at a lower point so that it breaks out of the strike zone. You don't want it to break in the hitting zone. You want it to break below the hitting zone, so you have to release it lower because you're not going to have as much break. But you still have an off-speed pitch with movement. There's no reason it can't be successful here. And that's really what Holmes and Foster have preached to the young kids. You know, and then you get a kid like Freeland. He was born 23 days after Coors Field opened in a hospital 5 miles from Coors Field. He wants to pitch here, you know, so he kind of sets a tone for some of those other young guys. And like, guys, I mean, I grew up here. This is the only place I've ever known. You can pitch here. And so you start to decide you can do it, and you look at it as something that you want to accomplish as opposed to something that you're trying to be passive about and not take the aggressive approach.
Visiting with Hall of Fame writer Tracy Ringlesby. Tracy, let's talk a bit about the Hall of Fame, because Edgar Martinez hopefully is going to get in this year. He's training very, very well. You and I had a conversation down at spring training, and for years you weren't voting for Edgar Martinez, but I understand you voted for Edgar this year. Tell me a bit about why you changed your mind on Edgar Martinez, and so many others I think have as well.
Well, I think the biggest thing is just coming to grips with the fact that the DH is part of the game, and I don't think the DH is as complete a player as a guy that plays every day, but it's a position in the game, just like it took a while to get the proper respect probably that relief pitchers needed, to start feeling like they belong in the game as opposed to the fact that they're failed starters. Your late inning relief pitchers are basically prime guys on your pitching staff with the way the game's evolved since expansion. You know, I mean, I think it's, you know, people talk about all this stuff with analytics and you've got to, you know, you can't let pitchers pitch the third time through. Well, don't tell Bumgarner and Kershaw that, okay? Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, Dave might have a thought on this, but I think it's not as much that pitchers can't pitch deep in the game, but if you want to go back to the pre-69 expansion, when everybody had four-man rotations, and you had 10 teams in each, so you had 80 starting pitchers at any given time. Well, now you've got 30 teams, and you've got a minimum of 5. Some teams even go with 6 starting pitchers. That's 150 starting pitchers as opposed to 80. That's almost twice as many. You're not going to have as much quality all the way through your rotation when you have that many more guys out there trying to pitch. And also, since the 60s, basketball and football have become attractive to athletes. In the 60s and before the 60s, baseball was the number one sport for any athlete to play. The other sports have taken away and have eaten away at some of that base. So I think when you look at all those things, it's not that you don't have as many strong pitchers or durable pitchers today as you used to have, but you have so many more pitchers, and now everybody wants to dumb the game down. Instead of taking advantage of the guys you do have who can go out and pitch deep in a game, they want to treat everybody the same because, you know, everybody has to get a juice pop and a candy bar after the game.
Tracy, I'm in total agreement with you, and you mentioned something about Freeland and, you know, how that impact has had on the rest of those guys saying, hey, you can pitch here. I believe the same thing is with starting pitchers. If they don't believe it early on in their career, then they're always going to be looking at that 100-pitch total and go, oh, I can't throw anything more than 100 pitches, because I think we're seeing a lot of that on the younger guys coming up. And then I go even a few steps backward into the amateur ranks, where these young guys who are, it's all about velocity, and it's not about trying to
get people out,
go deep into a ball game. Mm-hmm. You know, I go and I call some of these games where, you know, they come in, they're going to pitch one inning, and it's a showcase, and they're going to try to get light up that radar gun. So that's really not kind of building a base for a young guy to become Kershaw or Bumgarner who's saying, I don't want out. I'm staying in. This is my game.
You know, I spent 9 years, 9 years between Anaheim and Texas covering Nolan Ryan, you know, and everyone says he's a freak. Well, he was a 10th round draft choice, so it wasn't like he was a highly touted guy, you know. And he pitched on 4 days, every fourth day. I mean, he and Tanana would get in arguments over it because Tanana wanted to pitch every fifth. Dude, I remember him pitching on a Saturday in Yankee Stadium, a Saturday afternoon. We missed the play. We were going to go to a play. It went 11 innings with two rain delays. He pitched 10 and two-thirds innings to throw 235 pitches, and then 3 days later he threw a shutout. But he built up his arm strength. He would come to spring training, and he'd be ready. He would throw 100 pitches his first game out of spring training because he had spent the winter building his lower body. And that's the other thing. People think all this stuff about muscle work and stuff. With a pitcher, everybody wants to get away from the running and the building up of your lower body. But your whole strength in pitching and your push-off and absorbs everything, if you have the right mechanics, is below your waist. You have to have that strength. And if you have that strength, then you don't put strain on your arm. I don't know. I mean, again, I defer to David on that, but that's what Nolan has told me time and time again.
You know, he was a very unique and very special player. But let's go back to Edgar. We kind of got off track a little bit there.
Sure.
As you've changed the way you look at things, and I like the fact that you're willing to continue to look at things and maybe get a different perspective, what are some of the numbers that kind of grab you and why you change your mind?
Well, I think if you look at it, his second half of his career was actually better than the first half of his career. You know, his big numbers, I mean, he actually had better numbers at Safeco than he did in the Kingdom. And I think it just showed his maturing and his growth and his development. And I think he had the number of great seasons that you need to have in my mind. You know, I look at a guy like Schilling, he had 5 years where he won more than 15 games, and he finished under 500 in half of his 20 seasons. And so it's like, that's not greatness. That's like spurts of being really good and a lot of mediocrity. I don't think you saw that with Edgar. And I think, you know, part of what you have to look at with Edgar is that he didn't sign until he was 20 years old. And at that time, for a kid out of Latin America to be 20 before they ever got their first contract, he then had to kick around and prove that he actually belonged in the big leagues, right? I mean, he's like 27, I think, before he established himself up here. So I start looking at that, and then I have Jeff Scott beating me over the head. Tell the PR department where the Mariners, I respect him, but I got tired of having Jeff Scott yell at me. And Scotty just, you know, we talked over a lot of those things about it. And you know, Jeff was the assistant farm director, assistant scouting director, and the rookie league coach back then. And he's like, Tracy, this guy came in and everybody just kind of laughed because he was a 20-year-old kid from Puerto Rico. We were signing all 16-year-old kids from Puerto Rico. And he just kept pushing forward, proving to people that, no, I can do this.
Yeah, Edgar hit, what, about .173 in Bellingham. He thought he was going to be released, and they sent him to Instructional League, and the story got better. Visiting with Tracy Ringlesby, Hall of Fame writer. We're going to be back with Tracy, more with Tracy, right after this timeout.
All things Mariners, all off-season. The Hot Stove on 710 ESPN Seattle, 710sports.com, and the 710 Seattle Sports app.
Say, friends, single-game tickets are on sale now, which means you can lock in your seats to some of the biggest games of the year, including opening night, kids' opening day, fireworks nights, and big matchups against the Yankees, Dodgers, and more. Yeah, the Dodgers coming to town. Get ready for Mariners baseball at Safeco Field when you visit Mariners.com for tickets. Season gets underway early at the end of March against the Cleveland Indians, opening day 2018. Visiting with Hall of Fame writer Tracy Ringlesby. Tracy, there's still a lot of big-name free agents out there. Granted, it's not a great free agent crop this year. Next year's group of free agents will be. Arrieta is out there, and Darvish, Lorenzo Cain, J.D. Martinez. We haven't seen a lot of activity with the free agents. Scott Boras has a lot of those guys. What's going on in the free agent market? When do you think it's going to start to open up?
Well, I think the biggest thing is, one, where you've seen the movement is 12 of the 15 relief pitchers signed. But nobody signed for more than a 3-year contract. And you've got three free agents out there that are under 30. And if you start to look back, And this is where I think teams are starting to say, you know what, we've got to shorten up on these deals. We can pay a lot of money. I mean, just like Wade Davis got 17.3 AAV from the Rockies over 3 years, the largest AAV ever for a relief pitcher, but it's for 3 years. Well, at the age of 35, it's amazing how careers diminish. The skill set just drops at that point. And I think teams are now looking back, and you got a guy that's 31, 32 years old. They're going into free agency. These guys want 7 and 8 year contracts because they got into that a little bit for a couple of years there. So they're coming out and saying, well, I want a 7 or 8 year deal for $30 million or $25 million. And if you're a team, you got to look back at it and say, you know, do all your statistical analysis and try to adjust your infield based off of a computer as opposed to whether or not the pitcher can hit locations. You better start looking at it and realizing that, in general, it doesn't bode well to sign a guy that's 32 to a contract for more than 3 or 4 years. So guys are going to – there has to be a mental adjustment on that part. I think the other thing that's worked in it this year, the two teams that might drive that type of a spending spree, the Dodgers and the Yankees, they both want to be under the limit before they have to get into revenue, into the payment, into the penalty phase, which is like, I think, $197 million this year. Yeah. Well, the Dodgers right now, if you go over and you have to pay the luxury tax, the first year's 20, and by the third year you have to pay 50%, and then it stays at 50% until you go under the luxury tax cap, okay? Well, so if the Dodgers go under the $197 million this year, if they want to go out and go nuts for Machado or for Harper next year, they only have to pay a 20% luxury tax. They don't have to pay 50%. So I think when you add those two things together, the agents are having to come to grips with the fact of, you know, teams are making adjustments in how they're going to approach this so that they invest their money. I don't think it's necessary collusion, because I don't think any of these guys are smart enough to work with somebody else enough to collude anymore. And there's enough money out there, but I do think that they're saying, you know, I'll pay a lot for 3 years, but I'm not going to have it drug out and have my payroll exploded when you no longer can be a major contributing factor.
So the luxury tax.
Sorry,
go on, Tracy.
No, I was going to say, if my voice is getting squeaky, I scream for the Wyoming women to beat New Mexico tonight in basketball, so I'm trying to get my voice back.
I'm assuming you will be tweeting about baseball sometime soon and not Wyoming or horses.
Oh, my horses are good. Those are my babies.
Oh, love those pictures. Love watching what you do in the off season. You know, kind of getting back to what you were talking about there, the luxury tax is called the competitive balance tax. Are we seeing, is it working toward that? You know, not only the financial penalties that they have, there are also draft pick penalties if you're in there long enough or overspend too much. There's also international bonus pool money that is lost. Is what we're seeing as a result of this, is this a good thing for baseball? Do you think it's heading things in the right direction for the game?
Well, you know, I think so. I think that's the first 17 years of this century we've had 13 teams win world championships. We haven't had back-to-back world championships in the 21st century. You know, we're seeing teams, we're seeing more teams get opportunities. They may not last as long as a dynasty, but they're there. So I think the opportunities are coming better in that regard. And I think, you know, I don't think anybody that's involved with baseball, whether it be players with salaries or whether it be owners or whatever, can feel like they're really getting cheated. You know, I think everybody's doing pretty well. And so, you know, I think the system has had some impact in that direction. And I think the middle line free agent, you know, the guy that's mad that he's not going to get $30 million a year for 6 or 7 years, I don't have that much sympathy for him, you know. But I think the middle line guy is benefiting from this. And, you know, you're seeing middle relievers get $7 and $8 million a year. I mean, I don't think they can complain about that.
Visiting with Tracy Ringlesby. Tracy, you've wrote a million articles about different players. Besides Dave Valley, who's the most interesting player you ever covered?
LaTroy Hawkins.
LaTroy Hawkins? Why?
Really?
Yeah, I mean, this is a guy, I mean, he was a big-time high school basketball player in Indiana. He stuffed guys that went to the NBA, turned down a basketball scholarship, grew up in Gary, Indiana. I think most of us know what Gary, Indiana's like. Tough neighborhood, tough town.
Lloyd McClendon,
and
Jackson 5.
He really, by the time I got around to him, he was one of the really impactful guys on a team in all aspects. The guys really would turn to him. But as I talked to him, you know, when he went to rookie ball, he was going to quit and come home because he was frustrated. And he, you know, at that point, you couldn't go to another sport and play college level if you'd been a professional. And he called his grandfather, and he told his grandfather, he said, you know, I'm going to come home. I'm done. I'm not going to play baseball. And his grandfather said, really? He said, well, what are you going to do? He said, well, I'm going to come home. I'm going to live with you. He goes, well, that's not impossible. He said, why? His grandfather said, because quitters don't walk through my front door. Wow. And so he stayed. And then if you remember in 95, we had a strike shortened season, and he was one of the three guys that the Twins kept until they had to cut back to 25 players. And then he got sent back to AAA. And he said he went home at the All-Star break from AAA that year, and he was thinking, okay, I've got to get on with life. If I can't get to the big leagues, I'm not going to play. And he was hanging out with some of his buddies, and one of his buddies said, man, can you loan me $3? I need to get a bottle of wine. And LaTroy said, I'm sitting here whining about making money playing baseball, and my buddy from high school wants to borrow $3 to buy a bottle of wine. I need to get my priorities straightened out. And, you know, he wound up pitching 20 years in the big leagues. And like I said, even like the Cubs where he didn't pitch well, if you talk to Jim Hendry or if you talk to Gary Hughes, guys that were running that ball club, they said he was one of the most impactful guys they ever had come to Chicago because of his approach every day to the game. Wow. And then we can even go into now, he and his wife just bought a house that will hold 12 couples for the battered women's group in South Oak Cliff and Tech in Dallas. And I said, what happened? He said, well, first of all, they've got battered women's homes all over Dallas, but none in South Oak Cliff. Well, South Oak Cliff is the ghetto of Dallas. And he said, and my wife got into going to these banquets, and I went, and the year I went, the woman that spoke was deaf because her husband couldn't find his second boot, so he hit her over the head with a boot that he found until she could find the boot for him. And he said, I sat there and thought, there's a lot of sick people in this world, and these women need help. So, I mean, he's still giving back to things in the game. He's really, to me, he means a lot because this is a guy that, I mean, Gary, I was in Gary, Indiana when Lyman Bostock got killed. It's not a comfortable place to go.
So many great stories, and you covered so many wonderful players in this game of baseball. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us tonight here on Hot Stove. We appreciate it, and hopefully we'll see you real soon down at spring training.
All right, I'll see you guys.
Thanks for everybody for tuning in tonight. Produced by Kevin Kremen. Our thanks to our special guest, Mariner skipper Scott Service, here tonight, along with Tracy Ringlesby, Marco Gonzalez, and Taylor Motter on the Mariners Caravan throughout eastern Washington. For Shannon, for Val, for Kevin, I'm Rick Riz saying so long, everybody, until next week.